Welcome to Sci-Fi on Screen, the podcast that goes where no podcast has gone before. We here at Sci-Fi on Screen take a deep, close look at your favorite genre movies of science fiction, horror, fantasy, and comic book land. We go deep, scene by scene. We do comparisons of originals and remakes, and special shows. Just ahead, a new episode. And thanks for listening. Welcome back to another episode of Sci-Fi on Screen. This week, we're going to be taking a look at the fourth film in the Trek filmed franchise, Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home. I don't have any feedback this week as I've been on hiatus for a while, and most of my feedback went into the Dawn of the Dead episode, which is going to air, I believe, October the 2nd. So I'm going to jump right back into background for Star Trek IV. Before Search for Spock was released, Nimoy was asked to return. Already for the next film, supposedly where he had been under certain constraints filming three, Paramount gave him greater freedom for the sequel. Nimoy says that, you know, Paramount at that point wanted his vision. I guess Trek 3 did well enough where they were happy to have him take the reins again. So Nimoy and producer Harv Bennett once again kind of put their heads together. They wanted a lighter movie because 3 was very extremely dour, downbeat. They decided they did not want a clear-cut villain. And strangely enough, Shatner had said, "I'm not coming back." 3 was it for him. He was done at that point, which is kind of amazing to think about. So Nimoy and Bennett spent like 8 months thinking about maybe a prequel about characters of Starfleet Academy. So it wouldn't have had any of the original cast in it. They would have went back, kind of did like a Star Trek Enterprise, the TV show, you know, going backwards. But at the end of the day, it was basically a salary increase tactic for Shatner because he wanted to get what Nimoy was getting for the film, which is $2.5 million a piece. I guess Nimoy was getting more and Shatner was probably getting less. And so Shatner bargained to have Nimoy's down and his up. And they got into some clause about, you know, I guess Shatner, I don't know if this is completely Shatner, but like it was sort of a tit for tat clause where whatever Nimoy did, you know, Shatner was able to do in the clause. So Shatner was, if Nimoy directed, Shatner was then allowed, you know, next on the director's chair. And of course, he would come back to direct Star Trek V, the movie that no one watches ever again. Anyway, so that was kind of the background. There's a really interesting thing that I didn't know about that Eddie Murphy at the time, this was just pre-Golden Child. He wanted a starring role in the movie, and Nimoy and Murphy kind of put their heads together and realized that, you know, Murphy would bring a lot of non-Trek fans to the franchise, which was kind of cool because Murphy was like a shooting star back then, having done Beverly Hills Cop and Trading Places and I think Coming to America, so he was in the height of like good Murphy. But they were afraid that the script also might be ridiculed, you know, Eddie Murphy in a Star Trek film, and rightly so. I mean, it's very possible that it would have been a complete disaster. And so the idea was that Murphy would be a college professor who believes in aliens and likes to play whale songs, I guess, on his stereo. And Murphy did not like the part. He said he wanted to play an alien or a Starfleet officer. He went away to make The Golden Child, which was released pretty much around the same time as Star Trek IV was. And Murphy says the decision was a mistake, but I love The Golden Child. I think it's a really funny, consistently funny fantasy movie. So I don't know, I like it. So then they redid the character and it became marine biologist Gillian Taylor. The first run of the script, Paramount, I guess the execs were not happy with it, and they asked Nick Meyer, who wrote and directed, co-wrote and directed Star Trek II Wrath of Khan, to rewrite. So he and Harv Bennett kind of got their heads together, and Harv Bennett said, "Look, I'll write the parts that take place in the, you know, the 23rd century, and Meyer would write all the stuff taking place on 20th century Earth and San Fran." So they split it up that way and actually did it that way. So Nimoy has some quotes about what he wanted. His vision for the movie was, quote, "No dying, no fighting, no shooting, no photon torpedoes, no phaser blasts, no stereotypical bad guy. I wanted people to really have a great time watching this film. And if somewhere in the mix we lobbed a couple of big ideas at them, well, then that would be even better." End quote. Yeah, so I think they totally nailed what they set out to do. And one last background bit, the new cast member, the only new face we see here, Catherine Hicks, who I think a few years later would face off against Chucky in the very first Child's Play movie. I think it was Catherine Hicks, Chris Sarandon in that movie. So let's get into the film. Before anything happens in the film, we get a dedication. The film is dedicated to the crew of the space shuttle Challenger, which had exploded just after takeoff earlier in the year. I believe it was in January. I remember watching that. I was at a friend's house rehearsing. I was a musician back in the day, and we were watching the shuttle on TV, and all of a sudden it blew up, and we just stopped playing and turned up the sound, and really incredible, incredible moment. But so this movie, I believe, came out in June or summer, and so they dedicated it to the crew of the Challenger. We open with straight up credits, and there's a new main theme. So Star Trek IV, there's nothing recognizably Star Trek about the music. You don't hear the theme from 2, which I believe they would bring back. 2 and 3, I think, share the same theme, which I think they would bring back for 5 and 6. But it's this wholly new theme, and it's not a great one. There's nothing memorable about it. It's just there. So it opens up. It's a very odd thing because, you know, Trek, kind of like Star Wars, they pride itself on continuity and sound and theme and, you know, structure in a way. You know, when you're opening the movie, you're kind of getting us to the same, you know, well, I'm back in, you know, what I know, you know. And this is really weird. It's some new main theme that, you know, you'll never remember, and no one remembers because they you know, changed it, I believe, the next year. So we open up with the sound of the big probe that's coming to Earth. We start out on the USS Saratoga, which is a Reliant-class starship, so same configuration as the USS Reliant in Star Trek II. We see captain of the USS Saratoga, who is an African-American female, and what we're told is that this is the first female captain ever in a Star Trek story, which is really cool. So they're starting out in a great... The diversity in this film is really terrific. On the bridge of the Saratoga, you have one of those strange-looking aliens who look like kind of a Chinese sensei, right? They have the long beards and the mustache, and there's a lot of aliens on screen. So they really... It's great. I mean, one thing I like about certain Trek films is that they keep to the diversity. Even Abrams did that on the bridge of the Enterprise, you know, and on the bridge of the Kelvin. You saw aliens, you saw different species, really cool. You know, I mean, it's part of the Star Trek deal, man. It's not white people in space, you know. Never was, hopefully never will be. Enterprise accepted, obviously. What I'm told is that the probe itself was modeled after the title spaceship, or starship, I should say, in Arthur C. Clarke's novel Rendezvous with Rama. And if you think about it, really, it's just a large cylinder, which is exactly what Rama was. So very cool, and it looks great. It looks like some, you know, like the exterior looks like it's cast iron that it's just been painted over. Like it's a real rough-hewn kind of thing. It's not a shiny little spaceship, you know. It looks really cool, like galvanized metal of some kind. So let me cut back to Starfleet, our little moment. We find ourselves in the middle of this hearing, and the Klingon ambassador is there. You know, at this point in Star Trek timeline, the Klingon Empire and the Federation are still very much at war. We get this whole setup. The Klingon ambassador is charging Kirk with, you know, the death of... He's charging aggression for Kirk for blowing up Cruz's ship in the last movie, when, of course, Cruz was the aggressor. He charges Kirk with, you know, developing Genesis as a weapon and detonating it. And, you know, this is all aggressive action with the aim to, of course, obliterate the Klingon Empire. So then when Spock's father, Sarek, has this great dramatic entrance where he walks in and counters all of those charges with equal ones, you know, because they are absurd. And then the last moment we have, you know, there shall be no peace as long as Kirk lives, and he storms out. Already this film looks better than Star Trek III. I mean, the shots of the Saratoga are really good. Everything looks really high polished, high def. Production design is really great. The council section looks really well mounted, you know, looks very good. The lighting is very dramatic, really cool looking. And I just feel already with Star Trek IV, like we're back in Star Trek II territory, you know, and even one, you know, where it's, you see money up on the screen and it just looks great. You know, the future Federation looks really good. I feel like Nimoy learned really fast, because 3 is like almost a TV movie, and some parts of Star Trek 3 are so bad and so cheesy. But he really, really, you know, went to school, I guess, on directing, and, you know, this film, or he got another production designer. This film looks terrific. So then we cut to Vulcan, which is where we left off our heroes at the end of Star Trek 3. This is great, you know, a lot of great shots of the bird of prey sitting on a pad. It's bright green. They've spray painted it HMS Bounty, which is, of course, from Mutiny on the Bounty. And, you know, they're all kind of renegades at this point, so it's kind of cool they do that. And during this, we're getting a voiceover from Shatner, which is explaining everything that, you know, they've done all this, they've saved Spock, and now they have to go back to Earth to be court-martialed, basically. And there's this great scene where he walks by and the camera pans with him, and each member of the crew is I Captain, I Admiral. And they're all, you know, going to return home to face charges. And then there's this great long shot of Spock from a distance, and he's standing on this rocky outcropping, really cool looking. And then we cut to inside where he's undergoing these sort of final tests to confirm that he's fit to go back into service, and that his Katra, I believe, has been returned to his body. And the tests are great. He answers like maybe 8 or 9 questions, and they're all really cool, you know, sounding. And there's one where, like, what is the definition of unreal, that which does not exist, you know? And it's really kind of a fun little moment. And at the end, the computer throws him a curveball and says, how do you feel? And he's stuck on it. And of course, he doesn't know how to answer. Then, you know, his mother comes in, played by the great Jane Wyatt, who originated the role decades ago about Journey to Babel. And she's great. And she kind of lays it out to him, you know, you're alive now because your friends flipped that axiom of the needs of the many on its head. And they believe that the needs of the one outweigh the needs of the many. And, you know, you're only alive because of them. And at this point, it's, you know, Spock has a wonderful arc in this film. And he's like, as Spock usually does, strangely enough, he's like, well, my flawed human friends, you know, and his mother kind of smiles at him like, all right, so, you know, you'll learn. And it's a great moment right away. We're back in with character. You know, Spock, what's happened at this point is that he's retrained his mind in the Vulcan way. So, you know, we're setting up at the beginning of the film that whatever humanity that he had gained on the 5-year mission and in the films, you know, previous, that's kind of been pared down, that he's gone through this these Vulcan rituals to kind of restore himself, and that, you know, emotions now are even further pushed off than they used to be, which is great. You know, it's a great way to put him back into things, which is awesome. And I mean, already, you know, Spock was so missed in Star Trek III. I realized how much that movie missed Coy and Spock. You know, it was too much Shatner and too much other stuff, and not nearly enough of these beloved characters. So great that he's back in the thick of it. He plays such a huge part in this film that all is well. So we cut then to the Bird of Prey bridge, and strangely enough, it's amazing that the only time the Enterprise comes into being is at the very end of the film, where the Model A is revealed. I've read some scuttlebutt about that it actually was another ship, and they kind of just slapped the Enterprise on it. But who knows? But the whole film, I mean, very odd for a Star Trek film to not feature the Enterprise until, you know, just before the end credits. Really kind of cool. But that said, just all of them arrayed around the Bird of Prey bridge. Yeah, it looks a little different, but it's the same feel. You know what I mean? There's Sulu and Chekhov, or the helm and weapons, and Spock at the science station. Like, it doesn't matter. Like, somehow they get away with it, which is really cool. It doesn't feel any different. And this Chekhov has got this great line when Kirk sort of asks him, you know, are we ready to go? And he's like, Captain, we are in an enemy vessel and do not wish to be shot down on the way to our own funeral, which is awesome. And blessedly, Savik is left behind. There was some things I read about early drafts where Savik was going to be pregnant. And then it was her and David got it on. Because if you read the novelization of Star Trek II, her and David do have a relationship. Supposedly, you know, there was a point in the script where, you know, she was going to leave pregnant, but they threw that out, not wanting to complicate matters in any way. And then Robin Curtis is as terrible as she was in 3, because the film already feels so much better. Everyone is so much better. The president of the Federation, you know, all the stuff that happened at the council, the stuff with Spock and his mom, and there's Robin Curtis delivering her lines like a robot, gladly, you know, away she goes. So then Spock, of course, enters in his robes. He doesn't have a chance to, you know, get his uniform, which is kind of fun. He was like, I seem to have misplaced my uniform. There's so many great lines. I think there are more good lines in Star Trek IV than in, like, the entire franchise. They come one after the other, thick and fast. And it's great to have him more Vulcan and not entirely remembering the crew, because it leads to a lot of great jokes and some asides. And then we get a great long shot of the Bird of Prey leaving Vulcan and sort of flying into the sun. And then sort of en route, we begin to see that something is amiss in the solar system. Chekhov sees there's no assigned ships on patrol station. And there's this great moment between Spock and McCoy. McCoy, you know, goes up to Spock and he's like, you know, what was it like to die and come back? And it's this great line that he's like, it is impossible to discuss the subject without a common frame of reference. McCoy is, of course, outraged. You mean I have to die to get your insights on death? And then in the middle of it, Spock's getting some distress calls and he goes, I'm receiving a number of distress calls. And McCoy's like, I don't doubt it. You know, so just zing, bang, boom. They're back in each other's face again. Like, it's great. So now we're cutting back to Starfleet headquarters in San Francisco, and we're seeing that the transmissions of the probe has gotten all the way to Earth. On the way there, we've also seen some cool shots that it's knocked out almost every ship because of the power of its transmission beams. It's knocked out, I think, the Yorktown, which we'll see later. It's knocked out all the star bases, and everything's down. So it's in orbit. And now we see these, you know, the cloud cover is increasing, almost covering the planet. And so at one point, and great Brock Peters is there playing, you know, one of the Starfleet heads along with the president. You know, just convinces him that to send a planetary distress signal. And it's great. The shot in Starfleet Command is great because it's surrounded by screens. And you're seeing all this information come in and of storms. And, you know, it's just like it's a good solid tension moment of like, you know, something is up. Back on the Bird of Prey, or the Bounty, I should call it, of course, Kirk and crew begin to listen to the transmissions. And Spock suggests, this is so brilliant, the message may be meant for, not necessarily meant for human beings. And that the fact that the transmissions were directed at Earth's oceans, which is just a great start. And so Spock, right? So believable. Such a great plot point. I mean, the story in this is so great. It can be absurd at times, but it's crackerjack. It's put together really well. So Kirk then makes the leap and tells Uhura to adjust the signal for salinity and density as if it was being heard in water. And like all of a sudden, you know, Uhura has a job. Like, you know, like I think the great thing about this, and I'll get to this in a little bit, is everyone in the cast really has good scenes and has something to do. Uhura, right, 90% of the time, hailing frequencies opens captain, a few pithy remarks here and there, and she's out. You know, she's basically just there because she's part of the crew. Rarely does she have much of a role in anything, especially 3, where she was dispensed with in the beginning of the movie. It just sucked. So it was great. So all of a sudden, on the bridge, we hear Whale Song like we would normally hear, you know, which is really great. And she was the key to figuring that out. And then there's this really cool moment where Spock bails. He leaves the bridge. He gets to deal with a computer. And we see up written on the computer, phylum search mode. Which is cool because I think a phylum is a type of life form. It's the way I think species are set up into phylums. I think it's sort of another category that they're put in. And the fact they use that word is such a great Trek, right? Because Trek is all about they sneak the science in for real when they can. They fake a lot of it, but they like to sneak it in, and a lot of times, you know. So I love that little detail. And of course, it's matched up and it is the Song of a Humpback Whale. And it's great. We get this brief thing about whales being on Earth longer than man by millions of years, which is great. Yeah, and as soon as you hear that, you're like, what a genius story. How brilliant to come up with this idea, you know. Like, and I mean, just a perfect idea in so many ways. You know, you're getting an environmental message. You have to go back in time. Like, it's amazing. And it's Spock's idea to travel back in time by using slingshot effect around the sun to achieve warp point. You know, I think it's warp 10. All right, I think they changed the warp where there was a couple of episodes in the original series where the original Enterprise went to like warp 14. And I think they redid things to where warp 10 is the absolute limit of how fast you can go in the universe. And if you exceed warp 10, you start to travel backwards in time. So they swing around the sun and they achieve warp 10 plus. You know, Spock figures out how fast to go over warp 10 in order to get back to 20th century, of course. So great idea for a story, just great. And there's a couple of cameos actually in this part of the movie. And in Starfleet Command, when we're looking there, besides Brock Peters, we see cameos, multiple ones actually, by Grace Lee Whitney, who played Yeoman Rand, and of course Majel Barrett. You know, so and there's one moment where on a screen briefly we see Jane Wedlin of the Go-Go's. Her face comes up on a monitor, and as she's giving a report, you don't hear her voice, but it is her. So it's kind of funny. And then there's some moment in the loading bay where they're in the loading bay of the Bird of Prey, and Kirk's figuring out, like, him and Scotty are there. Can we build tanks about the whales? And it's this great line where Scotty goes, Captain, are we planning to take a swim? And McCoy answers, off the deep end, Mr. Scott. Just great line. Great line. And on the way back to the bridge, McCoy basically summarizes what they're going to do. And it's exposition for the film, you know, maybe for the non-sci-fi fans who don't really know Trek as well as, you know, maybe a lot of us do. McCoy sums up what's going to happen for the layman, as it were, which is great. It's quick and dirty. McCoy's outraged, but we get the information, and then they're back on the bridge. And so, okay, so the time travel stuff is no big whoop. You know, there's some goofy effects where they wrap around the sun, whatever, right? There's some weird morphing thing. This is of where, like, we see the faces of the crew, like, in this sort of white static. They form and then dissolve and form and then dissolve as if they're aging backwards or something. It's just, I don't know, it's really goofy. And then there's some weird imagery. It's sort of like 2001 slash Altered States. Light, very light. Like, it's just kind of, you know, some wacky thing is happening and that's supposed to be time travel and whatever. But then, this, of course, they arrive in 20th century. You know, it made me think here that I forgot how when the Enterprise went back to the 20th century previously, they weren't seen by, you know, the scanning materials of the time, how they cloaked the ship, because they're in a bird of prey that has a cloak. I don't know. They must have, when they came up with the story, they must have been like, wow, the Enterprise is gone and they have this bird of prey and it's cloaked. So if they go back in time, they can cloak the ship and no one will see them. It's just another one of those little things that kind of just clicks into place in this film, you know, like, of course. It makes it just so much more like inevitably true feeling that the cloak comes in handy and they can hide themselves from Earth. So you don't get into any kind of like, we've got a ship in orbits. You know, we don't get any of that dimension of stuff, which is perfect. So once they get there and we're introduced to a new problem, which is going to create some good dramatic moments for the rest of the crew, is that the Klingon dilithium crystals have given out under the strain of time travel. So we get this Star Trekian science. Spock theorizes that if we collected high energy photons from a nuclear reactor of the time, that it may initiate recrystallization of the dilithium crystal. So, cool idea, right? I mean, always Spock's always got like one kind of scientific miracle or another up his sleeve to get them out of shit. It's a really cool moment of like, oh, they finally got there, it worked, you know, and the dilithium crystals fail. So it's a really good, I think it's a good story driver right there, really cool. So then this is what they do great, is that they split the film up into three segments. And this is so rare for Star Trek. I think it's such a great idea in that Uhura and Chekhov will team up to find a nuclear vessel and get the photons. Scotty, Sulu, and McCoy will deal with getting the tank together, right? Sulu's got to find a transportation. Scotty and McCoy have to get the materials to build the tanks. And Spock and Kirk have to find the whales. Like, so smart. You know, obviously, most Trek films take place on the bridge of the Enterprise, so everyone's together working problems out. But I felt like this was such a clever way that most of the story is going to be told out of, not on the ship. The great thing is it wasn't Kirk and Spock doing everything, you know, like it wasn't Kirk and Spock dealing with every problem. Like, they gave everyone a task, and it's just, I think it was so smart, and it makes this film so much fun, and it moves along because you keep bouncing back and forth, and no story becomes boring because you've got to tell all three, so it's truncated a little bit. So just very smart, very smart. So many smart choices made in this film. And there's one little moment where, of course, you know, always when Spock has to go in 20th century or has to disguise himself as a human, the ears are in the way, and he just rips part of his robe off and ties himself a headband. Just very simple. It's like, all right, whatever. We'll go with it. You know, if it falls off, it falls off. But very clever. So at this point, Kirk's still kind of, Shatner, still kind of dour and flat like he was in Star Trek III. It's weird, but it, like, in a sense, Shatner kind of keeps his composure. You know, and his son is dead, right? So, I mean, there was a weird uplift at the end of three, but like so far in this, you know, kind of first act, beginning of second act ish, he's a little dour, and the cast around him is kind of livening things up, but he will liven up quite soon. They land cloaked, and there's this great, really cool shot of the camera is focused on a part of Golden Gate Park, and then all of a sudden we see the imprint of the landing skid. They rolled aluminum garbage can, and then we see it crushed flat, and then the ground depresses as well, and it's invisible. You know, it's invisible what's doing it, but it's a really cool effect. Like, really, really, just a sharp little detail. And of course, when they come out, the classic line: "Everybody remember where we parked." And all of a sudden, now the soundtrack changes to like this funk tune. You know, and it's almost like Trek's in San Fran. Look out! You know, like, it's now everything. The comedy now dial has been turned up like extraordinarily. So there's that great scene, really funny. Where Kirk almost gets hit by a car. Watch where you're going, you dumbass. Double dumbass on you. And then there's a really funny moment when they have to figure out how to get money, and he's thinking of selling the glasses that McCoy got for him in the beginning of Khan, which I think is a cool continuity thing. So him and Spock are walking away, and they turn around, and everyone else is just kind of standing there. And he's like, break up. You look like a cadet review, and they don't know how to like be casual, so they're kind of walking around looking stupid. Like it's really funny and very smart. The spectacles to get money. I think he gets $100 for it, and he doles out the money. Don't splurge. Very funny, you know. Like right away, this part of it, and so much of the San Francisco stuff is just so. I mean, it's just punchy. I mean, who knew Nick Meyer could do comedy? You know, like it's really, really, really solid. And there's a funny moment where Spock's trying to figure out, you know, where to find the whales. And, you know, Kirk sees George and Gracie advertisement on the bus. Then they're ejected from the bus before the bus goes anywhere. Admiral, what is exact change? So just like one line after another, man. Like it's really funny. And there's this really funny shot, too. And then we cut to Sulu, McCoy, and Scotty, right? And they're on their way to find an equivalent to transparent aluminum to form the tanks to carry the whales, and they're standing in front of a sign of a building that's painted yellow. It's the whole building is a Yellow Pages ad. And it's like, where would we find such, you know, it's just very funny, very stark shot too. I love it. It's like, it's a real visual comedy. And then we get this great scene of Uhura and Chekhov are, now there's a bit of scuttlebutt about this scene. Supposedly they put Uhura and Chekhov on this. It's the scene where they're asking where the naval base in Alameda is, right? At first, you hear that this was completely ad-libbed. They put Uhura and Chekhov in this street corner where they were interacting with real people, and it was a hidden camera. Not true. They were extras. However, the extras were told to just kind of look at them strangely and move on, and yet one woman actually opened her mouth and responded to them and said something like, it's in Alameda across the bay, and it's funny. There's this story that Nimoy saw the footage. They had to induct the woman into the Screen Actors Guild because to have a line in a motion picture, you have to be in a Screen Actors Guild. So she was just an extra. But because Nimoy liked the rhythm of the line and the spontaneity of it, she was quickly given her her SAG card, which I think is really funny. Then there's this great punk scene on the bus. Just awesome. Spock pinches the guy's nerve. His head pops down and the boombox goes off. Remember back in the day of boomboxes in the 80s, it's kind of funny. On the bus is a brief moment. This time when I was watching it, someone is holding an Omni magazine. You can see it like when they're shooting a couple of seats down from where they all are. You see someone with an Omni, which is, you know, if you remember Omni for a while, I think it was Bob Guccione published Omni in the 80s, which was a science fiction magazine, like the first and probably only glossy sci-fi magazine with articles on science, and they published fiction. I think you can read a lot of it online now. Someone put it up, the scans of most of it. Anyway, so there's this wonderful byplay between the two of them about colorful metaphors, you know, and Kirk says, oh, you know, this is how they talk in the 20th century. No one, you know, unless you curse, no one will even listen to you. And then they hack on two novelists. Kirk goes, you know, it's part of the literature of the time, the collected works of Jacqueline Suzanne and the works of Harold Robbins. And Spock goes, ah, the giants, you know. It's just an odd couple of novelists who are so far out of favor now. Like, their works have already faded now here in 2015. Anyway, it's kind of funny. So then we get the Cetacean Institute. We meet Catherine Hicks, who plays Dr. Gillian Taylor, who's the marine biologist. And it's great because Meyer writes it so the audience gets a little kind of refresher on whales. They have Kirk and Spock join her tour guide for a while she goes into a spiel about, you know, that they're not actually fish, they're mammals, and that whales don't have teeth, most of them anyway. And then we get a whole thing about whaling, their road to extinction, and they kind of stop in front of this TV. So it's great. We get a little like documentary inside of a movie, sort of about, you know, the state of whaling and the state of whales, you know, at that time. And during this, we finally meet George and Gracie, the two whales, which are mostly animatronic in most of this. And I'll talk a little bit about it at the end, kind of pissed off some groups, and they were mistaken about what they were watching. So it's great because we get a clock right now. So we get this timetable that Kirk and Spock start questioning Gillian about the whales, and we hear they're about to go to the open sea, that the Institute can't afford them, and they're adults now, and they're going to return them to the open sea. So it's a weird timetable, right? Because there really isn't pressure. I mean, they could go to the open sea and get any whales, but they'd have to find them and the whole deal. And so, I mean, it does create some nice tension where, you know, he's found two whales that are in jeopardy from whaling. Should they go back to the open sea? Anyway, it's really good. And then there's a really funny moment where part of the tour takes them underwater. to watch the whales, you know, in their habitat. And all of a sudden, Taylor's got her back to the tank, and Kirk sees Spock mind melding with one of the whales, Gracie, I believe it is, the female. And this old lady points at him, "Who is that man?" You know, Taylor freaks out. You know, what Spock has done, which I think, you know, this is so clever that they kind of, they continued kind of the Star Trek ethos, even in this goofy 20th century part of the movie. Like, Spock decided that he needed to get their permission. Like, so, you know, it wasn't like they were just going to beam the rails out and take the whales. Like, and I think this is just, you know, part of the really great details of Star Trek writing. And that, you know, through the mind meld, Spock communicated with Gracie and explained the situation and said, you know, "We'd like to take you," so on and so forth. And that they agreed to be part of it, which is just, I don't know, I think it's really great. And Spock started to use metaphors, "The hell I can't, Captain." And Kirk and Spock started going back and forth. Kirk's like, you know, "I don't think you should use these." But it's great. And for the rest of the movie, Spock's usage of, you know, "the hell" and "damn" are just all over the place. And they're awesome. Then the plot's kind of really ticking along here. Uhura and Chekov find the reactor. And it's great because what they're saying is that the carrier is the USS Enterprise. It actually wasn't the Enterprise. The Enterprise was out on maneuvers. But, you know, what a great moment to stick that also in the plot. So Gillian gives Kirk and Spock a ride back to the Golden Gate Park. And, you know, they're having their funny moments. And she's asking about why Spock is so strange and that he did a little too much LDS, which is that funny line. There's another line where she's like, "This isn't some dipshit," and Kirk has the classic, "No, ma'am, no dipshit." And then the great moment where Spock announces that Gracie is pregnant. She slams on the brakes. "How do you know that?" And "Gracie told me," and all this stuff. Really great, you know. Just somehow the balance between comedy and you know, Trek and their mission is kept here in this wonderful way, which is really great. Now we cut to what I think is, you know, Scotty's finest hour. They find this company called Plexicorp. McCoy has bullshitted kind of Scotty to get in by saying he's this famous engineer, Montgomery Scott, from the Glasgow Institute or something like that. And of course, right, they never told about the visit, so McCoy tells to Scotty, you know, they were uninformed that you were coming, and Scotty flips out. You know, "Never told I was coming," and he totally overreacts. And the engineer who runs the place is going to take him on a tour. There's a little aside when they get in the little, you know, truck that they're going to drive around in. And McCoy says, "Don't bury yourself in the part." Really great. And part of the rant is where he's like, "How we've come millions of miles, thousands of miles." Just awesome. And I love then, you know, when they finally finish the tour and they get into the office, there's this great moment where they discuss it. And like, this is an engineering problem. And it's beautiful because Scotty asks, you know, "How thick would a piece of your plexiglass have to be to withstand," you know, and he gives him a "how many pounds" in a water. And the engineer's like, "Oh, that's easy, foot something thick, whatever." I just love that. It's just a little moment of like two engineers talking shop. And of course, you know, then the classic, "Use the computer," and he picks up the mouse. "Hello, computer. Use the keyboard. How quaint." It's goofy in one way. Number one, like, it's a really smart way to, like, how are they going to pay for, you know, whatever plexiglass they're going to get from this guy, how are they going to pay for it? They don't have money. And number two, it's like that they're willing to alter history and, you know, give this guy this technology before possibly it was invented. It's again, you know, this is Star Trek light for sure. So there are things in this movie that are dealt with in much more seriousness elsewhere in the canon that are kind of a little flip. And the way I have to give Meyer credit, they do address the fact when McCoy's like, "Don't you think you're changing the future?" You know, and the line that Scotty gives, like, "How do you know he didn't invent the thing in the first place?" And that's meant to mollify, you know, those of us in the audience who are like, "What are you guys doing?" Right? Funny aside, that there's a product now invented in 2009. It's known as Alon, but its nickname is transparent aluminum. So you can go online and look it up. Just if you do transparent aluminum, you're going to get a Wikipedia page now that this product was invented. That very much is kind of what Scotty was talking about, which I think is just the coolest thing ever. And then Sulu, who's given very little to do in this entire film other than, you know, set course, he commandeers a helicopter. And they also cut a lot of what's Sulu was going to have a little bit more to do, which I'll get to near the when I do the notes at the end. But at least here, he's checking out and hanging out near a Huey helicopter, and he's talking shop with the pilot. And there's, you know, some great funny lines like, "I flew something like this in my academy days," and so on and so forth. So, you know, the lovely, wonderfully graceful Sulu, not giving much, but has some moments here. And then we cut back to Kirk and Spock, and they're, you know, they're basically dumping Spock off so that he can have dinner with Jillian, right? She's like, he's going to just wander around the park, and Kirk's like, it's his way. It's just so great. This has got to be the funniest, one of the few product placements in Star Trek. When Jillian orders dinner, she orders a pizza with a Michelob beer. And I was thinking to myself when I saw, man, I haven't seen Michelob, you know, for sale. Like, it's been gone for years. But I remember it came in those kind of, those wavy bottles, you know, very, you could tell a Michelob bottle just, you know, from the rest. Very funny that they're gone. So then we get some great details that the whales have radio transmitters that they're tagged, which rings very true. Which is how they track animals in the wild now, you know. And there's a radio frequency that she won't give away, which is kind of cool. And Catherine Hicks is great here, man. You know, she's not amazing in this, but she's solid. She's, you know, I buy her as this marine biologist who really gives a shit about what's going to happen to these animals. And there's this wonderful, I love this line too. And she's like, wait, don't tell me you're from outer space. And Kirk's reply, no, I'm from Iowa. I only work in outer space. It's awesome. And then another great line at the end of this scene, they leave early because I don't remember why they were in such a hurry. Oh, yeah, because I think Chekhov at that point has gone missing, so he has to get back to the Enterprise. He has to get back to the Bird of Prey that they're about to pay the check, and she's like, don't tell me they don't use money in the 23rd century. And he's like, they don't, which is awesome. Then there's this kind of fun, the Uhura Chekhov mission. You know, it's really funny. First, it's really great shots of the interior of a naval vessel, like very, very authentic feeling to them being on a naval vessel. And they're actually filmed aboard a conventionally powered, what they call a Forrestal-class carrier, USS Ranger, which carries the designation CV-61. And again, like I said earlier, Enterprise was out to sea, and yet, you know, in the mid-80s, in the height of the Cold War, well, maybe not the height of the Cold War, but you know, there's no way they're letting a film crew into the, you know, nuclear sensitive areas of a carrier. So, but they did a great job, you know, slapping up some nuclear danger signals, and it was filmed on a carrier. It was filmed on a naval vessel. It really feels great, and I like the little bit of plot here. A power drain is noticed by, you know, the command group, and again, obviously, normally some BS would for them to have Chekhov get busted and not Uhura. Because the dilithium crystals are running down so quickly and badly on the Bird of Prey, Scotty says he can only beam them back one at a time. The power is so low. And, like, it makes sense. It's real. Like, it's from the plot. The plot is they burned the bloody things out doing their crazy time travel maneuver. The ship's slowly losing power. Like, it, you know, if they didn't recrystallize the crystals, it would become visible. So, like, I just thought it was a very subtle detail of why they can only be in the back one at a time. But again, in any kind of movie, these subtle details often go unnoticed. But I think they have a subconscious power to, you know, make you knit a film together in a way where you're believing more of what's going on just from stupid stuff like that. So anyway, my little spiel about that. And then what a funny sequence when Chekhov is caught. The interrogation, he gives his Starfleet ID. All right, give us the ray gun. Make nice and give us the ray gun, I think he says. And of course, it doesn't work because of the radiation. He was so close to the radiation, which is, you know, solid. I'll buy that. And there's a quick goofy chase with really kind of funny music that ends with Chekhov, you know, leaping off of the ship, falling and hitting his head. And so he's on his way to the hospital. And then we get, you know, we're escalating now. The Jillian's boss had the whales shipped away before she knew about it because, you know, they wanted to avoid a press debacle, and that they realized how close she was. You know, I mean, think about it. She's a little crazy about these whales. She has no life, and she's, like, you know, in love with these whales, which is kind of interesting. It's the one tiny kernel that makes me think taking her back to the 23rd century was, like, not so egregious, but she's very unbalanced about them, and so they're gone, and so, you know, she bombs back to Golden Gate Park, and there's this great scene where Sulu got the helo, and he's bringing in the plexiglass, and there's a really small moment where you see, before Sulu takes off, he hits the windshield wipers by mistake, and the camera pans up to his face, and, like, you see this moment of, like, oh shit, I hit the wrong button. I don't know. It's very small, but it's really funny. As Jillian is pulling up to Golden Gate Park, there's this cool shot of the plexiglass being lowered into the cloaked ship. So you see the the chopper, and part of the plexiglass, and you know, it's being lowered into, all of a sudden it's disappearing. This is a great shot. They get the plexiglass aboard and everything's set, and then there's this moment where, you know, Chekhov is missing, and Spock chimes in. He's like, you know, Captain, we must rescue our shipmate. He says it's the human thing to do. So Spock's sort of learning about his his human half, as he had kind of forgotten it in his new, you know, in his new self. So it was really, really nice human moment from Spock. Then we have another funny sequence. I mean, they're so smart. The madcap sequence in the hospital where McCoy gets the shine, right? You had Scotty shining for the engineering bit, and now McCoy gets the shine in the hospital, which is so awesome. So he comes in and, like, he stops by this woman who's on kidney dialysis, and he's like, what is this, the Dark Ages? And he opens up a little package, gives her a pill, and he's like, you know, take this and call me if you need anything. It's really great. And he has throwaway lines, is this a Spanish Inquisition? And then, of course, it's a little goofy at this point, right, where they put Jillian on a gurney. They wheel her in to where Chekhov's being operated on. In order to get her in, McCoy says, this woman has, and he quotes this very elaborate name. And, of course, when they wheel her past the guards, Kirk's like, what did you say she had? Upper abdominal cramps, Captain. You know, very funny. And then there's this great moment where he has a disputation with the surgeon. He's like, drilling holes in his head's not going to help him. My God, man, let me save this man's life. And so Kirk takes out the Klingon disruptor, and he motions to, like, the doctors to get to kind of move away. And there's a throwaway line. Popular mythology has the main surgeon to be Harve Bennett, producer Harve Bennett, but that has not been substantiated. But as he's moving him back into the corner, the head surgeon's like, what is that? Is that a gun? Because it's the plastic, you know, it's the Klingon disruptor. But, and yet they're moving back as if it were a gun. Just a funny, funny line. And then there's a goofy little chase scene where it ends with them beaming out of an elevator. So, you know, the cops chasing them, the doors open, and they're gone. And there's this great moment where the doctors are fussing over the woman as they're being chased around the hospital. They go past the woman that McCoy gave the pill to. We hear the two doctors saying, it's fully functioning, you know, that she's growing a new kidney, which is just, I don't know. It was a nice moment for the film to have that tiny story with this woman. Now, here's the thing of the goofy part. First of all, a couple of goofy things. They get back to the Bird of Prey, and the ramp is down, and they all get on the ship via the ramp. And then the ramp, but Kirk's still out there talking to Jillian, right? And then the ramp retracts. And it's like, why would they retract the ramp? Kirk's still out there. He's just going to walk back in. He's just right behind them. But they do this because they want to do this next little scene, which is when Kirk says, you know, this is as far as you go. She gives him the frequency, and then when he beams in, she jumps on him. And it's kind of goofy because, like, you know, she's there, and all of a sudden, because she's jumped on and beamed into the ship, he's like, okay, you win. You know, all right, you know, you win, you can come. It's just, I don't know. It's very convenient, but again, we're in a fun plot here, so, you know, not too much to really nitpick. Spock has a great line here where I think Kirk asks him for an ETA on things, like, one damn minute, Admiral. and it comes out really fast. It's good. So they have this whole thing now that Spock has to make a guess, because in order to calibrate for the jump back to the 23rd century, he has to add in the weight of the whales in the water, and they make a big deal about him actually making a guess, which is, you know, his humanity again coming through. And there's the really cool moment of the, you know, the last bit of tension where, you know, the whales are out to sea already, and there's a whaler on their way to intercept them, and great shot of the whaler, and, you know, we see this massive powered harpoon in the bow of the thing, just this nasty, huge, ugly-looking spear. I mean, it's, you know, it looks great. Of course, you know, they shoot it at the whales. The Bird of Prey gets in front of it, deflects it, and then it decloaks, and they flip out, and, you know, the guys on the ship turn around, which is really great. And then there's this wonderful whale photography underwater, which was, again, mostly done by models. And they beam the whales up, and this guy, one of Scotty's greatest lines, because he's in the hold supervising the beaming, and Kirk is on the bridge, and he's like, Scotty, how we doing? He's like, Admiral, there be whales here. So excited. I have two nits here. One is they go to warp in atmosphere. Right when they get the whales, he tells Sulu, we need warp speed. And they go to warp in atmosphere, which I think is a huge no-no, like everywhere and any time. So in the tanks, from what I can tell, they beam the whales don't have any way to breathe. You know, this when they beamed them in, I think it's just, you know, they're in these full tanks with no, you know, there's no air. I mean, they've beamed all the water. And there could be. They don't really show you. And this is really a ridiculous nit that I should be shot for. But I don't know. I just thought about it. Like, you know, did they leave room at the top for the whales to breathe? But, you know, I'm crazy. Pretty much, you know, we have the time travel again, which is, you know, ho-hum, who cares? They crash land in the ocean in the 23rd century. And, of course, you know, Kirk's heroic underwater rescue of the whales because they'll drown. And I call it heroic because somehow he has found a toupee that will stay put even underwater. Whoever makes this toupee in this movie, you should do a commercial for, because it looks really good when he's swimming underwater and you see the hair. There's this one shot where he's swimming towards the camera and, you know, the hair is moving as if it was real, you know? So anyway, in short order, the whales answer the probe, it recedes, and as it, you know, as it's leaving, it's turning off its signal and everything's powering back up again. Ships are coming back on and Starbase comes back on. And then there's this really goofy moment where the bird of prey is sinking, but there's still a part of it that's above the waves and, you know, everyone's sort of hanging on. All of a sudden, to the sound of really goofy kind of comedic music, they all jump in the water and splash around and, you know, it's goofy. So then we cut back to the council chamber. Everything's over. Earth has been saved. They read the charges. And very, very clever what they did here, because of their actions and they saved the planet, they wipe all the charges except for disobeying orders, which is solely charged to Kirk, which is, I think, is great. And oh my God, does it work? Because he's been wanting, it ends the 3-movie cycle of him wanting to get back on the bridge of a ship. So he's demoted from admiral to captain. Makes me think now that, you know, him and Spock are the same rank, I think, for the rest of the movies. But it's a great coming home for Kirk, because at the beginning of Star Trek 2, and a little bit Star Trek 1, that, you know, he wants a ship. He's done being an admiral and sitting behind a desk, and he wants to be out. And now he's back. So that's awesome. And the parting of Kirk and Gillian, which, you know, for once in his career, Kirk is jilted. She's basically like, I got a lot of catching up to do. It's been nice knowing you. And he's like very surprised that they're not going to like hook up. But I thought that was kind of funny where she kind of bolts away and he's just sort of like, hey, wait. And then there's a really touching moment between Sarek and Spock that I love. Sarek says he recants his original opposition to Spock joining Starfleet when he was younger. And he says, quote, your associates are people of good character. I just, you know, I missed up on this one. It's just, you know, father and son coming together. It's a really beautiful moment. And then it's a great, you know, Spock has kind of come, again, he has the only really character arc here, you know, most of the time in these movies, that he's, you know, come back to his humanity a little bit and that his father's even grown closer to him. And it ends with, you know, give my mother a message, tell her I feel fine, which is great. And then we end with all of them on a shuttle, and there's just great banter back and forth between them as they're like, ah, they're going to give us a garbage scow. What kind of ship are we going to get? Ah, who knows? And then we get the reveal of the refit Enterprise again, but this time it's designated 1701-A. Which I think is different. I don't think there was an A on the ship in the first 3 Star Trek. So I think A is the first designation. Really great. And of course, you know, the first we see of Enterprise in an entire film, which is kind of amazing. And we end. Yeah, it's so great. I mean, I've said most of what I want to say about this film. It's such a fun Star Trek film. It has the Star Trek ethos in its environmental message, communicating with the whales to even ask their permission. There's a wonderful diversity all around the ships in the 23rd century. You have an African-American female captain. You have an Indian captain on the Yorktown. Just great, you know, just keeping with, I think, is one of Trek's strongest things. And, you know, very good diversity and all of its, all throughout Starfleet, you know. It's a wonderful environmental metaphor about, you know, if we continue to, I mean, it's more in vogue now than it ever was, you know. What a wonderful metaphor that if we destroy a species, that one day that we would in turn be destroyed as a result of that destruction. And, you know, you want to play that into what's going on today with climate change, you know, and all the things that we're doing to the environment, whatever level you believe is going on, it's still a hell of a metaphor and, you know, perfect for something like Trek to take on. So there's a little bit of trivia about 4. An early draft of the script, and this is where why Sulu has such small screen time. Early draft of the script has Sulu meeting a young child on the streets of San Francisco, who was his direct ancestor. According to William Shatner's Star Trek movie memories, the scene was an idea pitched to Harve Bennett by George Takei, who was delighted when he discovered the scene was to be shot. However, when it came time to film the scene, The child they hired to play the role was not a professional actor, and his mother was on set, causing the child to be extremely nervous. So they couldn't get anything done with the boy, and they had to move on. And so they scrapped the scene, much to the heartbreak of Takei. And I believe the scene was supposed to take place when they're standing in front of the Yellow Pages. I think it's a laundry. And I think even what's left in the scene is a woman who comes out the door, and that scene is Asian. And I think it was supposed to happen right there, that he's supposed to meet his great-grandfather as a child. Yeah, kind of a shame that it didn't work out. But boy, just because a kid couldn't get it together one day on set, you know, that we lose that shot. So it's too bad. Definitely too bad. This is the only instance in any Star Trek film where Kirk actually says, "Scotty, beam me up." Never actually happened before. You know, it's been a public misconception about "beam me up, Scotty," that he never actually said those words in that order. And he didn't even say them in that order in this film. He says, "Scotty, beam me up." Not beam me up, Scotty. So just a little bit of a nit there. This is kind of funny. Nimoy said that when the film came out, whaling rights activists caused an uproar because they felt that they filming these whales in their habitat was so disruptive that they've disturbed the environmental homes of these whales. And they had to be told that 99% of what they shot were animatronic models, you know, and it fooled everybody. So I thought that was really kind of funny. One thing they took out when the alien ship is approaching Earth at the beginning to look for the whales, there were originally subtitles saying, quote, "Where are you? Can you hear us?" Right? And the studio wanted to keep them despite Nimoy's objections. But then when they test screened it, I mean, this is amazing to me. The test audience indicated that the subtitles were unnecessary, so they were cut. Just like, that would have been the dumbest thing to have it, you know, subtitles say that, I think. And how funny that a test audience backed up the artistic decision of the director, right? So funny. And yeah, so our fun, that's what all I have pretty much to say on the awesome, fun, and breezy Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home. Thanks once again for listening to Sci-Fi on Screen, to my returning listeners and new listeners alike. If you like what you heard, head on over to iTunes and give us a review. We'd love to hear from you. If you have any suggestions about the show, you can send an email to scifionscreen@gmail.com, or feel free to leave a comment on the website, www.scifionscreen.com, and you can leave a comment in the comments section of the show page. If you'd like to support scifionscreen.com, you can go to patreon.com/scifionscreen, and that's Patreon is Patreon. And to make it easy on yourself, there is a button on the webpage that you can click. Patreon is set up so you can pick an amount you want to contribute per episode, and it'll be recurring. If you'd like to do that, that is available. We'd appreciate all the support we can get. And you can find us, again, our website, www.scifionscreen.com. We have a Facebook page, and on any smartphone, you could search for us on the podcast app and subscribe. Thanks again. See you next time.